You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Well, let me welcome all of you today to a particularly timely and, I think, unique event in some sense for Carnegie's efforts in Moscow, which now are approaching two decades. It's certainly obvious to all of us who have any interest in Russia and in the region around Russia that the last year has brought somehow kinds of change and the beginnings of trends and developments that everyone senses somehow mean something. The problem is nobody's quite sure what. And that question, I think, has been on the minds of practically all of us who talk about or think or visit or do research on what Russia is to become and what it is presently undergoing. Dmitry Trenin, who is my much-valued colleague and who runs our center in Moscow, has always been one of our most creative and thoughtful observers and analysts. And in particular, I think he approached this question of what's going on over the last year in a way that has been, all, as far as I know, unique for the center in Moscow and has brought together his team to produce a work that is unique in the works that the center has produced, as far as I know. Because it is a collective effort. The Moscow collective here has actually worked over a period of a few months to try to come to a presentation in this new paper, which is now available outside. It's called The Russian Reawakening, that tries to help those of us on the outside and probably in many ways those on the inside understand just what is happening to Russia's society, its economy, its traditions, its values, and so forth. And so I am very, very pleased that Dmitry has agreed to come and talk a little bit about the paper. I also hope he will say a word or two about how it came about, because it's not in Moscow, as those of you who know the center, always an easy thing to get people in the Moscow Carnegie Center to think alike. It is a testament to Dmitry's skill and his leadership that he managed to make that happen in this case, and to produce a paper that I think is probably among the best assessments of how we might think about what's going on in Russia in the coming period, as anything I've read from any source up to now. And so, Dmitry, I would like you to start, if you would, by simply saying a word maybe about how this paper came about, how much blood is on the floor, but and then give a sense, if you can, of the kinds of issues that you talked about and thought about as this paper took shape.
Jim, thank you so much. Thank you for this very generous introduction. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's great to be here. It's great to see you all. And I really look forward to what follows this introduction, an interactive conversation on the subject which I believe, strongly believe, matters maybe more than it's usually given credit for. Jim is right. It's taken us about the same amount of time to come up with a joint project at the Carnegie Moscow Center as for Russia or Russian society to awaken themselves after the traumatic period of the big change in the late 1980s and the early 1990s. And basically, we asked ourselves the question that Jim has formulated, what's going on? What do we make of it? And of course, we're saying what each of us thinks at the Carnegie Moscow Center, and people are very creative, and they come up with all sorts of analyses, but we thought maybe there is some common ground. Maybe we can come up with something that would be not a diplomatic paper that's negotiated in the usual diplomatic way, but something that would be more than the sum of its parts, something that would run deeper or be broader. And I must say I'm very grateful to my colleagues, whose names are there on the front page of the paper. They all agreed to take part. They all agreed to contribute. They all could bear with me through the process. And none of them has walked away from the finished text. And that's important. But, you know, it's a cat herding exercise. I'm not sure whether I want to repeat the experience, but I think it was worth it. A few comments. First, on the title. It's not the Russian uprising. It's not the change. It's not the revolution. It's not whatever. It's the beginning of the beginning, if you like. It's... I was struck myself. I used to come, when I came to this city, everyone has his or her own pet phrases. And my pet phrases were that in Russia, the private trumps the public, and that the Russian system could be best described as authoritarianism with the consent of the governed. I've been using these things also from this podium for quite some time. And then it occurred to me that these things were no longer completely relevant. That the public has begun to emerge in Russia alongside the private. That this famous consent is being partially withdrawn. That the country is moving into new territory. And also, make no mistake, this is not Russia's liberal awakening. Or any other adjective that you want to supply to the word awakening. It's the entire waterfront that gets more activism, from your Pussy Riot libertarians to the Orthodox fundamentalists to Islamists in Tatarstan. Everyone becomes a little bit more active. There's more drive on the flanks, as there normally is, on the radical left, on the nationalist right. And it's still limited, for the time being, to the urban groups of the population. But it's the process so fundamental that I think this is the real story happening in Russia. It's not the political thing. It's not the Kremlin thing anymore. I mean, who cares about the tandem that people spent so much time talking about in the past? The tandem is out of the window. More important things are being discussed right now. And I would say that this is a measure of society's success. Society which is which used the 1990s to survive, it used the 2000s to prosper, at least to a certain degree, for quite a few people. And now in the 2010s, your happy consumers are all of a sudden morphing into unhappy citizens, or maybe proto-citizens. But that's what's happening. And I think this is fundamental for the country. It's aimed at several things in Russia, this protest, if you like, this resentment, this activism. It's aimed at the political regime, and I'm not using the word regime in the pejorative terms. I'm talking about the power setup in which one person essentially rules on behalf of everyone else with the acquiescence of the vast majority of the people, pretty passive, who are happy with this setup, more or less. But this is a regime that's by definition unaccountable. It's arbitrary, and essentially you get the same figures all the time. Now, what's happening is challenging for the first time in any significant way the legitimacy of this setup. It's no longer seen as legitimate by the people who would be setting, in my view, and in my colleagues' view, are setting the trends in Russian society. But it's not just the regime. It's the underlying social political system. Call it crony capitalism, call it rent-based capitalism. A system which, as we say in this paper, corruption is not a bug in the system. It is the feature of the system. And the system which had this famous vertical of power, meaning that you buy people's loyalty with a license for those people to get rich in whatever way they want or can, is no longer becoming a sustainable proposition. And the sobriquet of thieves and crooks directed at the party of power has been taken seriously for the first time by the man who has just dismissed his defense minister and whose former agriculture minister and now advisor is under attack, essentially for the same reason. And don't tell me that Ministry of Defense is worse than any other ministry in the cabinet. You also have a situation in which the elites are being, or there is an attempt, let's say, to nationalize the elites, to enhance the, tighten the discipline within the elite corps. Essentially telling the people who have been accustomed to having their assets and property abroad and still serving the Tsar at home that you either part of your position as a loyal servant of the Tsar, or you repatriate your assets. That's quite a change, I must tell you, as far as the system is concerned. And then there are changes within society itself. In the last 20 years, 25 years, at least four Russias have emerged. A Russia that's, I would say, pretty modern, pretty advanced, the Russia that you see in places like Moscow and St. Petersburg, a Russia that's getting there, a Russia that will never get there, the Russia of the countryside, that's drinking itself away or out of this world very often, and the Russia that's, to a lot of people, not exactly Russia, the Russia of the North Caucasus, the Russia of that's culturally and civilizational terms quite different from the rest of the country. It's for the first time that those four Russias are engaging in a conversation not between them as society and the authorities out there in the Kremlin or wherever. The conversation is being held among people within the midst of society. You have any number of libertarians and gay rights activists. You have any number of Cossacks who hate those gay right activists and gay rights and whatever. And everyone has is become awakened. And you see all that happening. So the issue of values is now being discussed in a totally different way and in a totally different audience. In my view, society is becoming the main factor in what's happening in Russia. Whether society will be able to finally ditch its paternalism is the crucial question. Very briefly, where are we a year after the start of the protests. The government, in the broad sense of the word, has made some concessions. It has engaged in some still targeted repression. Some of my colleagues are talking about Stalin or Brezhnev. I think this is this is not applicable to today's situation. Not in no way. This is totally different. But there's also blanket deterrence, what I would call blanket deterrence, in an effort to stop a revolution that might topple the regime. And there's tightening discipline in one's own ranks. The Tsar has stopped being the Tsar of all Russians. He had to choose. He had to make a choice, and he's chosen the more conservative part of the party. This is very important. Up until now, you had the figurehead of the regime and the leader of the regime appearing a liberal to liberals, conservative to conservative, nationalist. Now he's taken a more principled position, and it's not just the person. I'm talking about the regime itself. There's more emphasis on conservatism. The systemic opposition has been caught between the system and being the opposition. And frankly, whether they find a way out of this dilemma will define their fate. They are moving toward the existential choice. The non-systemic opposition have, in my view, not presented, the people in the streets have not presented any credible alternative to the status quo that cannot be resuscitated, to the existing system as it even as it evolves. But they are the heralds of change, and they have come with some incisive and trenchant slogans, and they have some of the energy that manifests itself, and whether they will grow into something more mature, more serious, more responsible, link with the other forces in society within the system, that will essentially decide the fate of Russia. What does the future hold out? I don't see a perestroika 2 on the horizon, as some of my colleagues do. I do not see a repeat of 1917, the fateful year. I do not see a liberal Russia on the horizon, nor do I see a communist nationalist Russia reasserting itself. I wonder whether a new balance of political forces may come together and form what I would call, and some of my colleagues agree, what I would call a Russian republic, in which conservatives and liberals and nationalists and communists and so many others find some common ground and decide that they still have to live in one country and they have to do something about it. Whether society is there, I don't think it's there yet, but whether we're going in that direction or not is a big question. Whether we're headed, if we fail, whether we're headed toward a new dictatorship, which can only be short-lived, but could be pretty destructive, pretty chilling prospect, not to be totally discarded, or whether Russia will hit the path of degradation and quiet decline, not likely, having looked at some of the aspects of the awakening. Not likely at all. So what I would suggest is that we need to expect the unexpected. The protests a year ago had not been widely predicted. There will be spikes and troughs pattern in societal evolutions. Elections will be important catalysts, whether some of the regional elections, including to the Moscow City Duma in 2014, or whether parliamentary elections in 2016, or the presidentials of 2018, they will be important. There'll be impact of fluctuations of the oil price, the situation within the ruling elite, the situation within the opposition. All these things are immensely important. And very finally, what are the implications? The first thing I think is kind of obvious, but it was not present until literally last year, Russia, again, matters to Russians. We thought we had escaped that. We thought that, you know, each and every person was for himself, for herself, and society, the country, didn't really matter. We were proven wrong. But it matters to others too, frankly. Russians will sort things out one way or another. It'll take a while. The outsider's role can be positive and beneficial in providing a better overall context, a better environment for societal transformation. It may be less helpful and downright negative if outsiders try to involve themselves a little bit too deep into what's going on in the country. But the outside factor will be important. Even if the transformation is complete, when it's complete, Russia is unlikely to become pro-Western. I think it will, under whatever regime, it will continue to try to be an independent strategic player, call it great power, call it whatever you want to call it. But it can be a stronger partner if it all leads to a better economy, a more diversified, more modern economy. Could be a more co-equal political partner. But a failure to transform, I don't have to go into that. We all know what the doomsday scenarios tell us. So let me say in conclusion that what we have been saying at the end as far as, I wouldn't say recommendations, but, you know, some thoughts, suggestions as to what outsiders might want to look at. Economic integration, I think, will be crucial to the future of Russia. Russia joined the WTO this year. It's now set a goal of advancing toward OECD membership. That'll be the bar is much higher. There is, in principle, an option of a common economic space in Europe. It's been on the books for a long time, but it could be now that Russia is in the WTO. And the Europeans and the Russians have finally begun quarreling over the WTO implementation. So that promises the lively exchanges, but very, very detailed exchanges. Societal integration, visas, especially as far as the Europeans are concerned. I think the use of approved channels, whether that's universities or companies or science and technology channels, is less controversial than the use of other channels, political channels. But societal integration is one of the most important things that in which the outside world, the Western world, can positively impact on the transformation process in Russia. And lastly, we talk about some areas in politics and strategy world, from missile defense to the Pacific to the Arctic, where some cooperation could chip away at the notion of the West, the United States, as the enemy of Russia. And let me conclude by saying this. When I look back, let's say last quarter of a century, there's a period at the beginning of this timeline that I would call the time of revolution, the time of change, the time of breaking away from the for dismantling the communist regime, the imperial foreign policy, all the things that were accomplished back in the early 1990s. There was the time of the economics. I would say the 90s through the 2000s, where economics was the most important driver of change. I think we have arrived at the station where the social is becoming the most important thing. And the social leads to eventually to political change. At this point, Russia has reached a stage in which any further economic reform or economic transformation or simply sustainable economic policy can no longer be divorced from very serious changes in the political status quo. And that's what the awakening is all about. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Dmitry. And I think it should be fairly clear why the paper has its title, if nothing else, The Russian Awakening. Dmitry, I want to start off with, I want to ask you one question, and then we'll turn to the audience. In some ways, Mr. Putin came to power in 2000 in a society which was bitterly divided over what had happened to the Soviet Union and in 1991 and so forth. And he came to power as a president, as a unifier, someone who was going to bring together those warring factions that I knew so well from people who would demonstrate at the embassy on both sides and so forth. And now you're suggesting that he's doing exactly the opposite, that he has become the great divider. And he is somehow changing the whole nature of the idea of a presidency in Russia, which from the outset, as it was defined, was above political party and in a sense above politics. That was the Yeltsin vision of the presidency, and it's the one that Putin came in to inherit. What do you think the real implications of this are? You've said he's going for the conservative base, if you will. I mean, it may be even the majority, if we want to talk about it. But it also is changing the very nature of the leader, in a way, the image of it. He's now down and dirty. He's talking about I have a certain base of people that I'm going to serve, and the others are either going to shape up or they're out of the picture. What do you think where does this take us? Does it lead us, do you think, to a two-party system? I mean, the challenge is, how do you carry on the sort of idea that you're the only leader, and yet there's that whole other group out there that is in some ways maybe incoherent today and so forth, but which in a sense is the other in society? And I think it's a question I don't have an answer to, obviously, but I'm curious about how you see that fitting in.
I wonder whether Mr. Putin has an answer to that question.
Yeah.
My hunch is that Russia will have a two-party system when the difference between the two parties will be appreciably small. A big country cannot be torn in two very radically different directions. So I don't think that the two-party system is anywhere on the horizon. But what I see is Mr. Putin essentially, he's not only a pragmatist, but he's a guy whose steps are often driven by intuition. He sees a society that's changed considerably since the time when he took over. And he can no longer, I mean, there's a certain span. You can sit in two chairs or stand on two chairs as long as the chairs are not that far apart. The chairs are moving apart, and there are more than two chairs in the room. Mr. Putin has to choose. There's just no other way. I wouldn't call him necessarily a divider. Let me put it this way. He is not dividing society. He's making a choice. By having made the choice, he is dividing. So it's dividing, but out of necessity, if you like. He had to choose his base. This basically takes us to a partisan presidency that essentially is, in my view, a good development. In the future, a president or a prime minister or the cabinet will be seen as representing a certain coalition of interests, with other interests not being covered by that coalition, not being taken care of by this president, having to unite and present a credible alternative. So I see a normal process of the structuring of the political space in Russia, which, again, we've only seen the first glimpses of that, and we don't know how long it will take. But this idea of what's doing away with, I think, Jim, is it's doing away with the concept of a czar that's everyone's big daddy. And that's important, and that, I think, is essentially a good thing.
All right, let me turn this now over to our audience. Let's have a discussion. Marvin?
Yeah. You appear to be describing a totally new Russia and Putin attempting to put together the elements of a new political system, perhaps, and a new Russia as well. And I'm wondering if this is done on the basis of an ad hoc process. Does he have a particular role model in Russian history that he would like to see resurrected? I think I'm searching for something mm-hmm. that suggests a pattern of thought that goes from here to there, or are we winging it?
If I were to place Mr. Putin on the Russian, let's say in the alongside other figures in Russian history, I don't know. I think he to some he looks more like Nicholas I. To others he is more like Alexander III.
Yeah, no.
So that's where we are, I think. But both Nicholas and Alexander, of course, lived in a very in very different historical contexts. I think that Mr. Putin is experimenting. He doesn't have a grand plan, but he's certainly worried and concerned about the stability of the system that he built over the last 12 years. He's looking for new sources of legitimacy. Legitimacy is a key issue in all countries, but in particular in Russia. And this legitimacy is I think the key thing for Putin. And it cannot be simply bought with more handouts. It's much more complex than all that. So I don't believe he has a definite role model. I think it's an ad hoc process, but this process is geared to buy more legitimacy for the regime, for himself, and he sees himself as the guardian of Russia. In a pretty conservative way, he sees himself as essentially the one whose historical mission is both to keep Russia from internal disintegration and from too much pressure from the outside, and also to launch it on the path to some kind of development, economic development, first of all. That's what that's the way he sees himself. And for that, he doesn't have a role model.
Ariel? Use the mic. Eh?
Good to see you. And it's working?
Yeah.
Good to see you. Great job, as always. I wanted to ask you about the political culture, how that evolves. If you look at Russian Facebook, even if you look at the opposition discussion between itself, or opposition's plural, because you have to take into account the nationalists, the Democrats, for the lack of a better word, and the left, I do not find there a lot of new Russia and a lot of new political culture. Everybody is extremely self-righteous. Everybody is very hateful. People are using very undiplomatic language when discussing issues. people express diametrically opposed views. And I agree with you that there is an emergence of some kind of political life that the state doesn't control. But not everything can be done with ручное управление, because what you hear there, that you know, the top leadership is priding itself of keeping things under control with manual controls. And if these forces get out of control, what are your scenarios then? You said you don't see 1917. But if you get off the parliamentary path because the parliamentary path is not viable, and it's not viable today, what kind of scenario in the context of this political culture will you get? Thanks.
I agree with you, Ariel, that political culture has not changed much. I never suggested that, and that's I have to agree with you on all that. What I see, however, is a conversation that's being held within society, and that to me is the first stage of what might evolve into a new political culture. You start talking to the people whose ideas you may hate. You have there's a narrow boulevard in Moscow which I walk every morning when I walk to my office in Pushkin Square, and during the demonstrations of the last few months, the left hand side of that boulevard was used by the nationalists, and the right hand side was used by the leftists, and some liberals walked in the middle. But they were all walking together. Interestingly enough, I mean, I was stunned. I agree with what you've said, but one of the things that really stunned me, when I got the first glimpse of the demonstrations last December, was the monarchists' tricolor, and which is different from the official Russian tricolor, right? Waving side by side with the red flag of the leftists, of the left front, close to the white flag of Yabloko, and all those people came together to the same square, and they discussed things among themselves. And again, I don't believe that the opposition has done a great job of either having some leadership or some program or some strategy, whatever. I mean, I'm talking about non-systemic opposition, the people in the streets. But the fact that they managed to start a conversation among themselves is interesting. I don't know whether it will be a success story or a failure, but it's interesting. Of course, this is not the kind of political culture that you and I would probably wish to see in Russia. Now, the parliamentary path being not credible, I don't know. I mean, things may change. The parliamentary parties, you look at the Soviet Union. The thing that served as a bridge from the communist system to the system that Russia has today was a thing that no one really thought about. The Supreme Soviet of the USSR, I mean, goodness sake. And all of a sudden, that thing became the bridge. Over 280 million people walked, and nearly everyone was saved. I don't know what will happen. I mean, I'm not suggesting things will be fine. I'm not suggesting that things will necessarily be bad. I mean, Russians are famous for, gloom and doom, whatever. I don't buy that. So parliamentary parties may face a situation in which, unless they change their role, they will be out of the game. And that may push them toward a very different role from the one that they've been playing. And also, you have the leadership question. You have the leaders of the parliamentary parties, most of whom have been in their job far longer than Mr. Putin has been at his job. And, you know, those guys will essentially leave the stage. And we might see some new faces, and we might see some new policies. So,
Toby?
Thank you. Toby Gotti, Aikengum. I have a question about what you called the non-systemic opposition. It seems to me that that's most of society, business, civil society, middle class, all kinds of people, and those who've chosen, those who don't want revolution, those who see danger to their property or their personal lives from choosing the what you call the non-systemic, the systemic opposition. So my question is, why would a leader choose the parts of society to support that are the least productive? People who Alexander Aslan, for example, have talked about society being divided into those who live off the state, those who live in cycles, mm-hmm. in the creative part, so to speak. And why would a leadership choose to lose again that part of the population that will leave, emigrate, if they can't make a life there? Would the implications, I want you to address maybe what I think are some of the implications of that. On the domestic economic side, I think the implication is that the decision has been made that Russia will be a resource economy for the next 20, 30 years, and there's nothing that can be done about that, so there's no point in trying to cultivate the parts of society that would make that different. And in foreign policy is one of the implications that either the West will accept whatever choice Russia makes and learn to live with it, or that Russia can align itself with others like China and create a new constellation?
All very important questions, Toby. Thank you for them. Well, I think that you have a society where people who are strong enough to be individual, who are strong enough to stress individualism, and then you have people who are not strong enough, and people who live off the state. It happens in advanced societies. It happens in not so advanced societies like Russia's. Both groups vote. In fact, the people who live off the state vote more often than the people who do not live off the state. The Russian system is based on the legitimacy being given by the results of the elections, and no matter how you get those results, but it's the result of the election. And unless you get the support of that group of people who live off the state, you can never lead the state. And you have a paradoxical situation in which the most individualistic people on the face of the earth, and I'm referring to the Russian elite, are there where they are because they have the support of perhaps some of the least individualistic people in Russia, at least. And that's the paradox we're living with. Now, losing the creative part of the population, it's a big issue. And I do not think, frankly, that a decision has already been made, you know, in a stark way that you may have been suggesting, that Russia will remain a resource economy. I think that the decision was probably made that there's no way that in the next 20, 30 years we can diversify our economy to the extent that we can no longer be reliant on oil and gas. Oil and gas is your bread and butter. And you cannot, and this is something that you just you need to accept. But 20 or 30 years from now, that will not be enough. It may not be enough even before the 20-year timeline approaches. The oil price may plunge. The resource cycle may end. You're not exactly Qatar or Kuwait. You still have 140 million people They cannot live on oil and gas alone. So you need to diversify. And in order to diversify, you do need those bright kids. You do need foreigners. You do need foreign investment. Mr. Putin is now trying as best he can to come up with a better ranking in the world banks doing business index. It doesn't say I don't care about that thing. This is the thing he does care about. He talks about new industrialization. Again, this may be a far-fetched idea, but he is talking about it. And it's not something that's terribly popular with his support base. So it's there are big things in Russia. I mean, you will have to pay pensions. And how on earth are you going to pay those people, give them their pensions, unless your economy starts to produce something beyond oil and gas? It's a big question. I think that there are many, as Marxists used to say, internal contradictions in Putin's policies, but that's it. Foreign policy, aligning with China is not an option. Simply not an option. It would be a supreme irony in the world, having escaped America's tight embrace, let's say 10 years or 12 years ago, to run into the arms of China and become a tributary state to China. I mean, this is not what Mr. Putin or anyone in Russia dreams about. And there can be no equal relationship with China, as there can be no equal relationship with the United States of America. So you have to come up with something else. I do not believe that Putin or whoever in the Russian leadership, whoever is serious in the Russian leadership, actually thinks about aligning with others in a systematic, structural, strategic way. You can align with China at the UN Security Council. You can do things with somebody else on a given issue, but strategic alignment, strategic alliance, that's, you know, that's not for Russia, in my view.
There's someone in the back. Yeah. Oh, Andy? Yeah.
Thanks, Jim, and thanks, Dmitry, for your... Hello, Dmitry. Good to see you. For your fine analysis, what I've heard, there's a lot to agree with, and I look forward to reading the longer paper. In hearing your analysis, I'm reminded of a remark that Putin made once at our dear friend Lilia Shevtsova's favorite gathering, the Valdai Discussion Club, when asked, I think it was in 2007, how he viewed himself and how he viewed Mr. Medvedev, and he described himself as a conservative, and Medvedev as a liberal. And I think that, you know, accords with your sort of historical analogy of him as either Nicholas I or Alexander III. But now there was one guy and one center, which I think did come closest to predicting what happened last year, and that is our former colleague at the Carnegie Moscow Center, Misha Dmitriev, in the Center for Strategic Research. And his and his colleagues' analysis in the two reports published in 2011 was basically based on the assumption that the big difference between now or last year and, you know, 10, 12 years ago, what Jim was talking about, is that no longer was Russian society really monolithic, but that it was polarized, and that it's more or less polarized between the 47%, I can't resist, who live on the state and would never vote for Mitt Romney, you know, and those that do, and those that don't depend on the state, or as he described, the modernists and the traditionalists. Those that get their news from TV versus those that get the news from the internet, et cetera, et cetera. And I think you're right. Putin chose his strategy to decide with the more conservative, traditional group. Now, the challenge, though, if you buy Dmitry's analysis based on the, you know, socio-demographic research, is that over time, I mean, that assuming a reasonable level of Russian economic growth, and we're not talking about the 7 or 8% of the golden decade, but even 3 or 4% would do fine. At some time in the future, not too distant future, 5-7 years, the second group, the emerging group, will actually be larger, more influential than the former group. And so Putin does face a conundrum if he's really thinking about how he manages to stick around and play his historic role for the 12 years, if that's indeed what he's thinking about. So what would be your advice to him as to how he would kind of escape what would seem to be kind of a demographic political conundrum that over time is running against him and what he has created? And I'm wondering, in fact, actually, if what we're seeing to some extent already with this, I'd say, mini anti-corruption campaign may be an effort already to reach out and broaden the constituency that which he appeals to. I'm also reminded of when my Moscow days and running the Carnegie Moscow Center in the fall of 2003 and the galvanizing effect of the arrest of Mikhail Khodorkovsky had in changing political alignments. This is a different order of magnitude, but what would be your strategy as if you took on the role of the political technologist?
Well, now, Mr. Andy, first of all, great to see you, and thank you for this, for your remarks, actually, and for the question. I don't think Mr. Putin will ask me to give advice. Right. But I think he needs to realize that he is Russia's recent past. He is Russia's present. He is not Russia's future. The more advanced groups in society have left him behind. And they would have left anyone behind who had been there for 12 years in the Kremlin. There's no question about that. His historical role could be and should be making sure that Russia continues to transform itself and eventually transforms its political system, which is the one element in the transformation which lags behind the social and the economic. You basically still have personalist political system with a president as a modern day czar. So that Russia makes that transition or achieves that transformation without breaking itself apart. I see Putin as he is conservative, he is autocratic. But I see him as a Russian nationalist. I see him as a guy who cares about Russia. The way he sees Russia. He doesn't care only about, the more mundane elements in life. I think he has a larger vision and the more, and the goal which is larger than himself. And achieving that transformation could be his historical, even historic contribution to Russia's history. I think he is now trying to, he's engaged in an extremely complex and potentially dangerous exercise. He's trying to limit corruption within the system without bringing down the system. And when you have a system built on corruption, institutionalized corruption, it's almost a mission impossible. And yet, he needs to find, a narrow channel between the Silas and the Charybdis. In trying to do that. So my very short advice to him would be building institutions, supporting parliamentarism, this Supreme Soviet that could be of use later on, supporting political formations in opening the political system, while committing them to civic nationalism, while committing them all so that these various parties do not tear Russia apart when you let them loose. the thing that happened to the Soviet Union. So you cannot afford it as far as Russia is concerned. It will probably not go down as quietly and essentially bloodlessly as the Soviet Union did. We don't know, but it's a high risk operation. You can never be so lucky twice. So that would be my advice. But he is not listening, and he is not asking for my advice. So I'm just giving it to you and to the audience.
Charles.
Dimitri, if somebody asked me this afternoon what your central message was, I might say the following in one sentence. Very big things are happening in Russia, but you don't really know where this is all going. And I appreciate that, because not only was your analysis very probing, but you also elaborated on all the things that you don't know. And that, of course, is the mark of a very good analyst, and the candor is particularly appreciated. Now, to add more uncertainty to the confusion, my question is, does the official West, Western governments, including, of course, especially the United States, do we have a stake in the outcome? I don't mean the analysts, who most of them are in this room, who are still interested in Russia for Russia's sake, but rather governments. Does it matter?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is the question I'm spending a lot of time thinking about. I think it matters more than people usually think it does. People have essentially relegated Russia to the sidelines of global politics, and which may be fine. I mean, Russia objects to that, but Russia should in fact appreciate that. The worst thing in the world would be to land at the top of the U.S. foreign policy agenda, in my view. So when you're somehow, you know, you're out there, no one really pays much attention to you, you're not involved in any serious conflict with any serious country, and or even countries that are, well, any country really. I mean, there are a few things, but really very few. But if Russia goes down, I mean, what I'm trying to say is the status quo, which has been there for some time, and Russia was not moving anywhere. And you could, and people could afford to essentially ignore Russia because it's not moving. Now, if it's not moving sideways, not moving up, but let's say going down, that may have bad implications for the neighbors, but also for others, and that would put Russia on other people's agendas, and in a bad way. And if Russia becomes in my dictatorship scenario, becomes more isolationist, becomes more hostile to the West, primarily to the United States, and some people are doing are implementing the things that Toby mentioned, that we need to align with China because that's the one, whatever. Then it becomes a matter for other countries' concern. On the other hand, should Russia become more of a, but this is not a short-term proposition. If, let's say, over a period of time, say, medium term, even longer term, if it really finds a way to revive itself economically. And my thesis and my colleague's thesis is that it cannot revive itself economically unless it revives itself politically. There's no way that you can achieve sustainable economic growth unless you deal with those things. You may not start with the idea of democracy, you may start with the idea of corruption, or you may start with the idea of the business climate, whatever, but you have to change the system. Otherwise, the system is so stifling that you will not be able to achieve anything. If Russia becomes more of a presence on the global markets, but then I'm I'm on the flight of fantasy. I will stop here. Then it will matter. But I don't see this happening anytime soon. So probably it doesn't. It will not matter much more. But I would say, even today, I would say this. I'm baffled by the fact that when the Secretary of State wrote her pivot piece for foreign policy, she named just about every country in Asia Pacific, and she admitted Russia. Very interesting. I don't think it adds to the strength of U.S. policy in Asia Pacific if you do not have a place for Russia in U.S. Asia Pacific strategy. My other example would be the Arctic. I think it's an important region, important for the future in terms of transportation, but also in terms of energy, and Russia is certainly a country with whom engaging with whom would make some sense. And thirdly, my pet subject with Jim, missile defense collaboration. If a deal, if just imagine a deal could be reached between the United States and Russia on missile defense in Europe, that eventually, in my view and our colleagues' view within the EASY Commission, that would transform the entire, over time, the entire strategic relationship between the United States and Russia to replace the adversarial post-Cold War relationship of residual adversity with a relationship that could be that of strategic collaboration. And then no matter what happens between the United States and any other major power in the world, and we don't call names, Russia will not land on the wrong side as far as the United States is concerned. It may not become U.S. ally, but it will not be somebody else's ally, as Toby has just suggested. And that's something, in my view, worth fighting for.
Celeste?
Thanks, Dmitry. I too look forward to, we're all going to be busy this evening, I too look forward to reading the paper. A lot of questions have occurred to me, but I'm going to go back to the one that occurred to me when I heard you speak, and it's not unrelated to some of the others you've heard. You were kind of laying out, this could happen, and one of the this could happens is that Russia becomes weak and irrelevant, and then you quickly said, well, that, you know, can't even, we're not even going to think about that, go on and move to the next one. And I wanted to stop you, because, and it's related to part of your answer here. If I think about the trajectory that Russia's on right now, that's where it's going.
Down?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And what clarified that for me when I was listening to you is if I was in charge of a project, you know, futures project, trying to figure out Russia's futures, the hard path I would have trouble designing, the low probability path, would be getting off the trajectory down. Mm-hmm. What are the things that need to be done to get off continuing reliance on natural resources at a time when oil and gas are going down? And in terms of being sources of flexible wealth, at a time when Gazprom can't even develop Stockman. I mean, how hard can that be? I mean, they can't even do the easy things in the area where they're supposed to be strong. Russian demographics, regional issue. I mean, you could go, your report, it sounds like I said, I can't wait to read it, lays it all out. The harder scenario to come up with is what kinds of political developments get Russia off this path. And that's really hard to figure out for many of the reasons you just laid out. Thinking that Putin cares about his sort of place in history as saving Russia, well, maybe, you know, I don't know, but the actions that he's taken in the last year don't seem to indicate that he's woken up to that. The whole Serdyukov event is not about fighting corruption, in my view. It's about making sure that the allocation of corruption remains in the control of a guy in the driver's seat, and that the people around him know that. So I think that the interesting task is to figure out what would be the steps that Russia needs to take to not be weaker and irrelevant in the 21st century, and try to come up with that scenario rather than saying we kind of, you know, trying to come up with a scenario in which Russia becomes weaker, because it seems to me that not total collapse, mm-hmm. not revolution, not mm-hmm. explosive mm-hmm. irrelevance, mm-hmm. but the continuing gradual decline mm-hmm. that Russia's been on, frankly, as a result of the policies of the last 12 years under Putin. So that's the scenario I wanted to ask you to think about.
Well, I think the decline scenario is, well, first of all, you rightly said that Russia has been on the declining path. I would say not over the last 12 years, maybe over the last 40 years. I think mid-60s was more or less the high point. And after that, you had a, not like this, but gradual decline. There was some plunge. At the end of the Soviet Union, because you lost much of your international relevance alongside with many other things. But there are two things about Russia. There are things about Russia as a state, and there are things about Russia as a hundred and whatever million people. And I would say that even as things have gone pretty badly for the state, things have gone pretty well for the ordinary people. You see living standards in Russia that, frankly, I'm not a politician working for a seat on the Duma, and I'll say that, frankly, Russian people, many of them do not deserve the standards of living that they're enjoying right now. You have pretty low productivity. And yet, you have it's difficult as someone who needs, you know, menial work done by somebody. You have to overpay that person to do anything for you. It's just so. What I'm trying to say is that the whole idea of this report is that some people have started to care about Russia. That's all. Most people still care about themselves. They don't care that much about Russia. And who cares? I mean, it's, whether it has important international relevance or not. It may be important for a politician, a statesman, a propaganda hack, but not for the ordinary people. They enjoy the standards of living and the quality of life that, frankly, have been unthinkable in the entire previous period of Russian history, including much of the 20th century. So, decline? Sweet decline. What kinds of... is the trajectory down as a state? I think it looks like Russia has more or less stabilized. It's not a given that a country that used to be an empire, an ideological mecca, a nuclear superpower that challenged the supreme power of the United States for a few decades. It's not a given that a country that lost, you know, on all those three things would not simply, you know, wither away into the oblivion that happened to so many other former empires. Now, Russia has managed to go down a few notches and stabilize there. It doesn't exert much influence beyond its borders, but it makes sure that no one else does within her borders. And that's what's important for Putin and others. They have their own interests, but that's... what kinds of things could wear Russia off the trajectory? I think corruption has become... I would disagree that it's all about control. I mean... I wouldn't say that Putin had been unaware of what had been going on in the defense ministry and whatever in the agriculture ministry. He was aware of all these things. Not that there was no clannish struggle, and the clannish struggle has always been there. I think what he is, and this is only my, I mean, not even my colleagues would subscribe to that. Some of my colleagues would say it's not a fight against corruption. It's what, clannish struggle, whatever. It is clannish struggle, but what really made it so important was, I think, Putin's realization that his legitimacy and the regime's legitimacy needs to be shored up. And that this corruption accusation is actually very serious. And it could be the undoing of the thing that he had built. It was a very, I cannot imagine anything other than a supreme crisis, agonizing. The decision to let go of Serdyukov was one of the most agonizing personnel decisions that Putin has ever taken. He is not the guy who easily, throws his associates to the wolves. He's not that kind of guy. I think he understands, he feels that this is the thing to be done. Otherwise, and corruption has gone to, I think, to the close to the end of the rope. I believe that the fluctuations in the oil price in the future could offer a few other stimuli to look for something else. The situation with the pensions fund. There are many things that people are becoming really incensed with that I think will demand a different kind of approach from those who govern Russia. I think pensions reform is very important. Or the pension situation is very important, not the reform. But the pension situation is very important. Corruption situation is very important. I don't know. Maybe not enough. Maybe not enough. But I stopped myself, as you could see, cut myself real short when I started talking about, how important Russia could be. Russia is important to the Russians, and that's fine. And we can live with that.
Yeah.
Hugh Grindstaff, this is from a non-Russian analyst. I think Putin is one of the most underestimated leaders around now. He ruled, and then he got into the back seat while Medvedev drove. And what he saw in the back seat, he's been able to now come back and see what he should have done when he was in the front seat driving. So to me, Russia really hasn't really gone down that much, but there's some future things like Sochi, the Olympics in Sochi, and now Russia has emerged as a possible arms supplier for both Iraq and Afghanistan. And that's sort of the outing of Russia again. So would you like to comment on that?
I don't know whether Putin is underestimated. I really don't know. I think sometimes there's too much attention given to him at the expense of the fuller story of the country. I think he sat during the Medvedev presidency, he sat in the back office and allowed the young president to be the front room salesman for the country, more or less. He never divorced himself from the levers of control. The Medvedev presidency was Putin's third presidency. Russia is an arms supplier. Well, yes, but I don't think it changes much, frankly, whether Russia supplies arms to Iraq or whether people prevent Russia from supplying arms to Iraq or Afghanistan. I think it's a small thing from the global perspective or from the Russian perspective. Whether Putin will be able to modernize Russia's own army, that's a big question. But that's an important question. When he does it, it'll be important to know whom he and the people around him see as the enemy. And that's important. So $600 billion that they are planning to use to modernize the army after a 20-year neglect, how this money will be used. And again, what is the strategic scenario behind it all? That's an important question, to which I think this country can supply an answer or not supply an answer, but this is something that really has some relevance, I think.
Jane?
Thanks, Mitri. I want to pick up on your comment about Russia and Asia. You don't see much, you don't hear much about Russian strategy for Asia. Mm-hmm. Russia really, am I wrong to think that Russia, in a sense, is self-isolating in Asia on a lot of global issues? When you have a conversation at a conference, whether it's about global financial markets or global warming or new sources of energy, you don't hear Russian voices really taking an active part in this. Is this a misperception, or is there a conversation that's developing and brewing? We're missing something. Thank you.
Jin, you are missing nothing. not in your position, and clearly not with your intellect and expertise. I was complaining that the country that has strategies, has policies, doesn't have a spot for Russia. My ambition has not reached a level which I complain about Russia not having a strategy, about things that do not directly or intimately involve Russia itself. It doesn't have a strategy for Asia, I agree. It doesn't even have a strategy, a grand strategy for China, which it should have. But I think that there are some elements, some building pieces, some building blocks for a strategy for Northeast Asia, which does matter to Russia, which is of relevance. We'll see whether what emerges at the end. But these guys are good with they're good with tactics. They're fine with operational things. They don't think much about strategy. That's not the way they were trained, not the way they're thinking. Too bad, but that's where we are. Does Russia care about global issues? Not really. Because as we discussed many times, Russia, unlike the Soviet Union, is very much inward looking. It's not doesn't spend time or money abroad. Doesn't want to remake the world or, you know, improve the world. It focuses very much on itself. It's very defensive. It cares about other people coming too close to Russia or doing things that the Russians object to, again, in Russia's vicinity. But apart from that, we can't care less. It's just there are a few things that Russians do care about. When they, for example, the Syria story, it's mostly about the global order. It's not about Syria. It's not about the Middle East. Russia is not an actor in the Middle East. It ceded the place 20 years ago. It's not retaken that, doesn't have an appetite for that, but it doesn't want to establish the practice of foreign military intervention or regime change from abroad. That's all, more or less. So you have this country. Is it your ideal country? Certainly not. Is it better or worse than the Soviet Union? You tell me.
Okay. Yeah, Marilyn.
Marilyn Pfeiffer with CRDF Global. You mentioned at the outset that you saw the awakening as primarily an urban phenomenon. So I'd like to ask a question which is part demographic and part geographic. Do you see it primarily as being limited to the capitals? Is there a difference in tone throughout the extent of the Russian Federation? You mentioned the North Caucasus very briefly. Is there a homogeneity of thought across perhaps the rest of Russia? Or does Putin have a strategy that differs according to various regions?
As just discussed.
Dmitry, let me Ray, did you have a question too?
I can tie into this a little bit.
Because we got
around the State Department. Mm-hmm. First, a direct one, which is Jim mentioned the sort of oppression that limits the growth and development. Has Carnegie Moscow specifically had any more pressure, threats, et cetera, because of its obvious American connections? But to follow up a little bit on Marilyn's question, and really the same type of one that Andy asked, what advice would you give to the new Secretary of State coming in on how to deal with Russia? I mean, you've had a few lines here about pay more attention to this and that. You know, 60 seconds going up in the elevator with our new Secretary of State in January, what would you recommend? But I appreciate a short answer to that first one about oppression in Carnegie. Thanks.
Okay. Well, if the new Secretary of State is someone talking to the senators this morning, I spent time at dinner with her a few years ago. I don't remember what I was talking about. She doesn't remember me, of course. I think my piece of advice would be very simple. Think in terms of U.S. interests, U.S. national interests. Don't think in terms of Russia's. Blunt as it can be. CMC, Carnegie, Moscow, more pressure. The paradox and the irony of the situation is that we do not fall under the new laws that govern Russian NGOs because we're not a Russian NGO. And that gives us all the liberty to do whatever. So far, we have not been pressured. We have not been mentioned in dispatches. We have not. It's a bit surprising, and I'm waiting for a bombshell to explode in my computer screen. But there was a meeting that our good friends Alexei Arbatov and Vladimir Dvorkin had in Moscow this morning, today, it's Tuesday. They presented a book on nuclear issues, and that made into a news story that was shown on Russian television. So, you have accusations of people being foreign agents. At the same time, you have people interviewed for the national media. It's a mixed bag. You never take chances, but you never lose your heart. Marilyn, it is an urban phenomenon. Yes, it's mostly limited to the capitals. It's mostly limited to the people who have some security in life. Essentially, it's about the people who've taken care successfully of their daily needs and a little bit more. And now they have the luxury of thinking themselves as citizens and thinking of the rulers as being accountable to them, thinking about the rule of law. And it's very simple. You managed in the difficult 20-year period, you managed to have a decent apartment, you managed to have a decent car, you managed to have a nice dacha outside that is called dacha, but in reality is something more than that. Your kids are at a good school, you travel to wherever, you spend your holidays, but you step out of your apartment, you're in your blessed Moscow street. You start, you drive your car, and the roads are packed, and the rules are non-existent. You can't park, and the roads are in bad repair. So there's a limit to which you can succeed as an individual. That's the lesson that people have learned. And now people are becoming a bit restive. In many other parts of the country, they're not there yet. There are many depressed areas. Russia, there are regions of Russia that are elements, pockets, maybe apartment-sized pockets of Russia, which are on a par with similar apartments in Europe. I'm talking about middle class, but there are areas of Russia which are on par with Africa. And you still have the same country. Do they have a strategy? No, they don't. I think I tried to explain that. Especially as far as the Northern Caucasus is concerned. It's a big thing. That they don't have a strategy is one thing. Do I have a strategy? If you push me hard against the wall, can I just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5? I'm not sure and that's fine. But even the people who are dealing with the Caucasus, you press them real hard against the wall. It's difficult. It's not an easy thing. There may be a few things that they will come up with which are worth being implemented, but it's hard. It's real hard.
Dmitry, I think we're just about out of time, and I want to thank you very much for this. I would again remind people this paper is outside on the table, and I hope you will have a look at it. I think I would conclude only by saying, Dmitry, that one or two of the things that are frequently said about Russia really shouldn't be. One is that they're going backward. History never goes backward. Time passes, and you have choices always in front of you about where you go. And what you're suggesting, it seems to me, is that people are now beginning to realize again that there are real choices to be made. And that the way they're going to do this and the way the way it will emerge is very unpredictable at this point. I think your comment about a discussion is a very important one. Discussion doesn't mean people sitting around a table. It's not. It may be the kitchen table and the tea, but it also is those demonstrations and guys on horseback who don't like the guys who aren't, and so forth. But it's a discussion, and that is going to change things. And what struck me and strikes me about what you're saying is that this essentially is out of control. And that probably is the single biggest change, in a way. And I think in terms of change, I was struck. I had not been to Vladivostok in more than a decade, and I was at Dmitry's invitation about a month ago. It's a changed city. It is a changed region. What struck me about it were two things. One was a statement somebody gave me who told me that in the city of Vladivostok, women outnumber men 2-1. That says something about what people see as their future. And they don't see it if they have opportunities in many ways in Vladivostok. The other was that this group sees itself as part of Asia. Yes, it's part of Russia. You know, they sort of complained about this in many ways, that they suffer from all of the things that Moscow sends them. But they see their future as a part of this other region. Another piece of the challenge, it seems to me, that people are looking out as well as in. No matter what the government or the conservatives may want, there are huge parts of that country that look elsewhere also for inspiration or their future. And that's going to be a challenge. But thank you very much, and thank you all for coming and for good questions.